Wagner James Au thinks there may be a metaverse in your future. He joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we explore the various incarnations of the metaverse, including Second Life and Mark Zuckerberg's Meta. We also discuss the birth of the metaverse in Neal Stephenson's novel Snow Crash and its appearance in many sci-fi books and movies.
Military veterans started meeting with each other in Second Life, and so they're anonymous through their avatars. They're all over the world, they're all over the country, but they would start meeting together and discussing really deeply personal issues like their PTSD or their injuries in combat. And so it was very powerful for them. Like I wrote an Atlantic piece about this. I quoted a retired colonel who said, yeah, like some Marines are telling me that Second Life works for them like nothing else has done before. So I think a lot of the organizations miss that. So I'm making a big focus of my new book, Making a Metaverse That Matters, to say, no, see what's organically evolving in metaverse platforms like Second Life, like VR Chat, like Rec Room, like Roblox, because you'll often find organically emerging really powerful real world use cases like that.
Welcome to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. Our guest today is Wagner James Au. In addition, we are joined by Wendy Grossman, author of Net Wars, and of course, Scoop Sweeney and I, John Lebkowski. And we're here to talk to Mr. Au about his latest book. But in addition to that, we may stray into other territory, including his previous book. He's written about digital culture, he's written about the metaverse, and he's been writing about that stuff for many years, going back to when he was an embedded journalist in Second Life, which was probably one of the earliest metaverse kind of platforms. Yeah. In fact, it was the metaverse for a while for many people. You were Hamlet Au, right? Am I pronouncing that Au?
Yeah.
Do I have it?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
That's right.
And then this latest book is called Making a Metaverse That Matters. And telling people that you're the world's greatest authority on the metaverse. and certainly I credit you with being sensitive to the hype around the concept of metaverse and virtual worlds. But how did you become an authority on Second Life?
Well, that's a kind of wild story. I started out in the late 90s, sort of a young freelance journalist in San Francisco, and I was writing for Salon.com and Wired. I write about game culture, and I got really fascinated with the modding community in games, which is, by modding, that means you can... the users can take the editing tools within the game itself and they can make whole new levels and experiences with the game tools. Because often the game developers will just give the tool set away to the players and say, here, go ahead and make your own things. And I started noticing that a lot of the user community would become very ambitious and make really amazing content to the point where they were starting to create on an equal level as the actual professional companies. So I thought that was really fascinating. And at the same time, an MMO came out, a massively user online game called The Sims Online from Will Wright, the famous game designer. And his idea with that was to keep a light touch as far as what the company imposed on what the users did. Usually with these MMOs, you know, the game developer gives you quests to accomplish and baddies to fight and levels to upgrade. But with Will, his idea is, well, why don't we just give the players the tools to create their own experiences and see what happens. And so right as this was happening, a small San Francisco startup called Linden Lab was developing what originally was called Linden World and kind of had that same spirit, but very much was... inspired directly by Snow Crash, the novel by Neal Stephenson, which describes the metaverse in really amazing detail and has been very influential to developers who got their start then. And they so they were what became known as Second Life was inspired by Snow Crash, but also Burning Man to a large degree, because the co-founder Philip Rosedale started going to Burning Man around that time, that kind of had the thought, well, what if you could bring an experience like what you have in Burning Man to an online internet community, so everyone could access it, as opposed to just a few thousand who could, you know, willing to go into the Nevada desert.
Oh, so, I see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So while they were showing it to me as something I might write about, the idea came out as, well, maybe you could write for us. And because they already had an early beta community in early 2003, and it was already becoming a pretty thriving emergent society. So they said, well, maybe we need a town chronicler. Actually, I found out later it was Howard Rheingold, the very famous kind of internet community pioneer intellectual. And he suggested it to Living Labs. Like, well, maybe you need a chronicler. So I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And so I became the embedded journalist for the first 3 years, and had like a little avatar reporter. I got a white suit for my avatar. It was kind of my pretentious tribute to Tom Wolfe, and just started roving the world and meeting bizarre characters and going into war zones and seeing conflicts and dramas and art and culture just kind of emerging from nothingness.
Yeah, I just recently understood that I used to think that you were writing about Second Life, but you were really writing for Second Life.
Well, both, yeah. But I discussed early on with the company, like, well, I'm going to write about the community because it's going to be inherently a conflict. I mean, it's already a conflict because I'm a contractual writer, but I just said, well, I really want to take the reporter side seriously. So give me independence to go in the virtual world, and I'll write about whatever is there. Like, often it might, for less progressive companies, they might be shocked by the stuff I was writing. Like, I started, well, like one of them was, a social, like kind of a social gaming kind of emerged very quickly, where people were role-playing, going to nightclubs, taking their avatars to nightclubs and sex clubs and things like that. And very soon, a private detective started emerging, because the private detectives would be hired by one party to make sure the other party that's supposed to be their partner is not cheating on them. So that was one of the stories I wrote. But yeah, it quickly became amazing. But yeah, they were very hands-off on that.
I think of it as being like a reporter in a local reporter in a, you know, in a large urban area or a small town or a state or something, you know. And in the early days of the internet, that was kind of how I thought of what I was doing, was, you know, reporting on my country, so to speak. But
yeah, that analogy works. Especially,
but it's an interesting thing, because one of the things about it is, a journalist who comes from like a tabloid newspaper like The Sun in the UK, you know, they don't care if they piss off the people in in the place they're reporting about, because they're not coming back. They're not going to live there. It doesn't really matter to them. But if you're a reporter in a small town, or a reporter in a place like Second Life, you obviously want to tell the truth, but at the same time, you do have, you can't burn your sources every story, because you're gonna need to be able to get along in the world well enough to collect other stories. So I think it forces a kind of accountability.
Yeah, that's very valid. I'd even say even a sense of protectiveness around the community, because you meet these amazing people and they're sharing their stories with you, and so you want to present them as fairly as possible. And you know, also kind of, you know, well, there's so many inspiring stories, and want to convey those, just to see so the outside world sees the whole kind of thing and sees what's possible.
You do say, though, in the new book, that your enthusiasm for Second Life maybe led you to not be as effective a critic as you could have been.
Yeah, that's very true. So I think what happened is I got very passionate about the user community and how amazing they were. And at the same time, Second Life hit a hype wave period where, between 2005, 2010, roughly, where there was just all these outside companies that wanted to build experiences or included in their own content. For example, the Office TV show had a whole episode devoted to Second Life. And so it kind of felt like the big corporations coming in and sort of swamping the community. And I felt very protective of the community, like thinking, no, what the community was already building here was already the most interesting thing. It's not, you know, the fact that Reuters came in and put made an official news bureau in Second Life. That came later, and they're really not part of the community. And at the same time, though, and this is kind of echoes what you're saying, is, and I thought, well, maybe the community is going to become as huge as what everyone's saying. I started believing, okay, maybe this really is the metaverse, and we're going to see not just 500,000 people, which it was at the time, to, you know, millions of people. And so I really, I kind of bought into that for a while, just from the kind of osmosis of just everyone talking about it, but also seeing that there was really amazing content and communities in there, and assuming that it would scale. So yeah, I kind of missed that for the first few years.
Well, when you functioned as a reporter, did you do the investigative reporter duties of looking for people that are not doing the right thing for the community? And did you encounter those kind of people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a big controversy for me, was there was a lot of griefers, you know, like how you grief online, like on a chat board, but you can do the same thing in the 3D world. But with the 3D world, you have content creation tools. So, for example, one way of griefing was it's called the gray goo effect. Kind of Kurt Vonnegut mentioned it in one of his novels. But you can create an object, but then you can script the object to create objects. So it infinitely starts creating objects. So like a lot of griefers would start creating these kind of self-creating machines that would start spewing, like one popular one was just started spewing images of the Super Mario Brothers through the world. It would just kind of spread like pollution through the grid of Second Life, to the point where, because the servers couldn't handle all that content, it would actually bring the servers down.
It's basically a little bit like of trolling going on there.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I decided early on, I'm really not going to cover them, because just the very nature of me covering it would encourage them to do it more, because they'd be, oh, I got the, because then my blog started getting a decent amount of readership and started getting picked up by like the Washington Post and places like that. And so, yeah, that's one good example of just deciding, yeah, I'm not going to give coverage to people that actually actively damage not just the community, which is already bad, but also just the kind of the infrastructure of the world.
You don't want to start another Gamergate.
Yeah, no, yeah. This is a lot of stuff we saw with Gamergate, kind of definitely saw early echoes of it in Second Life.
Yeah, that would have preceded Gamergate.
Did you know that the Department of Work and Pensions in the UK spent like $100,000 setting up in Second Life to see if it would work for them as a way of interacting with the population?
No, but I wouldn't be surprised. There was hundreds of universities and nonprofit organizations in Second Life.
I knew about it because I was asked to write a piece about it.
And, oh, okay.
And they were coming in for a lot of criticism for spending the money that way. And I sort of pointed out, what I wrote was, look, this is a tiny, tiny amount of their budget. And, you know, maybe it's worth this kind of experimentation to see if this is a communications medium for the future. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what happened to it after that, though.
What's really interesting to me is there are socially powerful uses of virtual worlds, including Second Life, that I think a lot of organizations like that missed. They kind of just sort of, most of them recreated like their hospital or their university in the virtual space. But with that, what we saw is, for example, like military veterans started meeting with each other in Second Life. And so they're anonymous through their avatars. They're all over the world or all over the country. But they would start meeting together and discussing really deeply personal issues like their PTSD or their injuries in combat. And so it was very powerful for them. Like I wrote an Atlantic piece about this. I quoted a retired colonel said, yeah, like some Marines are telling me that Second Life works for them like nothing else has done before. So I think a lot of the organizations miss that. So I'm making a big focus of my new book, Making a Metaverse That Matters, to say, no, these are the, see what's organically evolving in metaverse platforms like Second Life, like VR Chat, like Rec Room, like Roblox, because you'll often find organically emerging really powerful real world use cases like that.
The thing is, you know, that's one thing that strikes me as not all that different. I mean, in Second Life compared to all the other communications media we have, people with problems who find each other seem to always be able to give each other support. Now, I realize that PTSD in military is a special case, and maybe the VR mattered, but maybe they hadn't tried online community before, and maybe that was just their first experience. Do you know?
Well, and you know, I devote that a section in the introduction about this, just that trying to convey that virtual worlds, because it's an immersive 3D experience, you have a sense of presence, that you are sharing the same space with other people. I quote a Stanford study that they found when people control different avatars in the same virtual world, they start unconsciously recreating the same rules of eye contact and personal space that we do in the real world. So if your avatar is standing too close to someone, like an inch away, and that would be very jarring in real life, and it's actually jarring for people. Like they move their avatars back, and so they follow the rules of personal space that without even being told in the virtual world, that's the same that they would in the real world. So I think that conveys the magic of these spaces, that you do have that sense of presence and that shared existence in that virtual world space with other people.
I thought it was interesting where you said that not having non-human avatars was an important part of avoiding some of the real problems that occur normally.
Thanks. Yeah, that's been fascinating to see. A lot of that came from my interviews with Nick Yee, who's kind of the avatar expert for the last couple of decades. And yeah, he was pointing out that choice of avatars, what you can be, has very, very weight behind it. And for example, if it's only realistic humans, it starts bringing in a lot of our real world prejudices and assumptions around who is an attractive person. So you'll have a lot of racist behavior that starts getting recreated, if it's a hyper realistic avatar, it creates an expectation around materialism, kind of the, you call it the Malibu effect. A lot of Second Life is like that, because as the avatars have become more hyper-realistic, kind of people just sort of unconsciously say, well, if I look very realistic, I should make myself as pretty as possible and spend money to update my avatar to get the best hairstyle. And I guess I should have something really nice in the background, so I'll buy a mansion, you know, like a beach house. It sort of unconsciously shapes your experience. Whereas if you choose to be a robot or a furry, like a furry is like a humanoid animal, then it totally changes your experience. So it's very important to have different options, and people understand that there's many ways of expressing their identity, so the culture doesn't get shifted completely over to like kind of that whole Malibu experience.
You know, one thing I didn't see in your book, and you may not have really known about it or turned it up in your research, but I think maybe the first instance of metaverse after snow crash was something that happened right here in Austin, where we created a LAN for an event here called RoboFest. And this was put together by a guy named Doug Barnes, who at the time was a sysadmin and later became a tech attorney. And Doug Barnes actually knew Neil Stephenson. And in setting up this LAN, he wanted to include a Moo. So they added a Moo and they called it Metaverse Moo after Snow Crash. And, you know, it's like a text-based virtual reality. And Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games had provided the computers for this LAN, and he got really fired up about metaverse. He decided he wanted to make it a product. And that led to the launch of IO.com, Illuminati Online. That was actually created as a home for Metaverse Moo. And just incidentally, it was also an internet services provider. And ISP became its main business. And the Metaverse Moo kind of didn't work out as a commercial product. But that was my first exposure to Metaverse, other than Snow Crash. And I always thought that was a pretty cool instance. But again, it was text-based.
Yeah, I had a feeling Steve Jackson was involved in the Metaverse concept at some point. But yeah, that's why I devoted a chapter to talking about the origins of the concept and go point by point through the novel Snow Crash, because it was so influential, but also talk about how Neal Stephenson himself was working on one of these early virtual worlds and trying to actually create the Metaverse. And I mentioned some of the early ones from the mid-90s, or even before that. There's one called Habitat from LucasArts, and that's from the late 80s. So people have been trying to build this since then.
And CompuServe hosted a thing called Worlds Away, which I think was owned
by Fujitsu.
And I remember interviewing some people about it at the time. And, you know, they had one of the first protests I'm aware of in a virtual world where the residents, you could spray paint things. And the residents, because the cans that the paint came in were colored the color of the paint, the residents figured out they could use them as sort of bricks, and they would build things out of these bricks. And they basically staged a protest to get permanent turfs, I think it was called. No turf, no something. And, you know, one of the CompuServe people told me about coming down one morning and finding all these avatars lined up chanting. You
know? Love it.
And what they wanted was basically the ability to have a permanent home that they could decorate with these paint cans.
Wow.
Interesting. I'm wondering about VR and Metaverse. In your book, it's kind of clear that you don't think of them as being the same thing, but a lot of people do think that they're kind of synonymous. What's the difference? I mean, how is VR different from, or more than, or less than the Metaverse concept?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this, because I feel like inadvertently my book is like trying to address the last 3 years of hype and misinformation around the Metaverse. Primarily promulgated by Meta and Mark Zuckerberg, because kind of they bought the Oculus VR headset and sort of fashioned their concept of the Metaverse around the fact that they spent billions of dollars on VR headsets. But Neal Stephenson himself has said this repeatedly. I mean, he decided you don't really need a VR headset to access the Metaverse. Literally a year after Snow Crash came out, because a year after Snow Crash came the video game Doom, the 3D video game, first person, and immediately convinced him, okay, I get enough of an immersive experience just through a flat screen, you know, PC. So you don't really need a VR headset. But even in the novel, if you read it, only the elite have standalone VR headsets. But most people he described it kind of like it's like a telephone, like a public telephone sort of contraption. So it's not really VR as we usually understand it. So, yeah, even in the novel, you can see that there wasn't kind of that assumption is going to be all VR, at least in the sense that Zuckerberg describes it. But so you have that. And then, like we were discussing before the call, Dana Boyd, one of the most respected researchers in technology, she has done research that women, girls have a propensity to get nauseous using VR. And she published that right after, she published an essay about this right after the Oculus acquisition in 2014, saying, is Oculus inadvertently sexist? And she talked about her studies and research. What was really interesting is she mentioned there was studies in the Netherlands, I believe, of trans people as they were transitioning from female to male and were taking male hormones. The way that they perceived a virtual 3D changed. They actually became more proficient. So there might be a hormonal basis to this. So it was really interesting research, but even more interesting, and kind of, if I was a shareholder of Meta, I'd be shocked. I've talked to at least five people at Meta. This has not even been looked into. I talked to John Carmack, who was their senior advisor, and he was the CTO of Oculus. He's like, I asked him about it. He said, that's not really in my department. I talked to Corey Andreka, who actually, he was the co-founder of Second Life, and then he got Meta to acquire Oculus. And he said, yeah, it's important, though, as far as I know, they have not looked into it.
Well, the fact that people have so much trouble with 3D movies kind of suggests to you that there might be some issues there, right?
Exactly. And so I'm just kind of stunned. They haven't looked into it. They've spent tens of billions of dollars without really pinpointing whether literally half the population might have a propensity to puke if they wear the headset. So it's just kind of mind boggling. But yeah, that's another reason I like to say, I think we should say that VR, it's one way among many of accessing a immersive experience, i.e. the metaverse.
Well, in his book, Dodge in Hell, Stevenson outlined the pros and cons of living in an actual metaverse. And I found his observations pretty telling. It's like, sure, you can be anything and do anything, but there's a lot of bad actors who could achieve the same thing for bad ends rather than good, enjoyable ends.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. He said this before in other contexts, that the metaverse, as he sees, is neither good or evil. It's neutral, and it's what people put into it. You can definitely see it used for evil. Like that when the metaverse buzz started a few years ago, some people were saying, well, you know, the Snow Crash novel is very dystopian. It's about America. The world is basically falling apart, with the implication being, well, that's why people go in the metaverse, because the world is so horrible. And Neil said, no, not really. It's, you know, it's just one way of accessing, or, you know, it could be good or used for good or bad. I misspoke. And then also the fact is, Neil Stevenson himself, he just co-founded a metaverse company called Lamina One. And I devote a whole chapter interviewing him about the forming of Lamina One, which to me is really interesting. Like you said, fail and dodge and hell. Lamina One, the company he founded, he was explaining how it's a summation of pretty much all his novels, not just Snow Crash, but also Fail, also Cryptonomicon, because it's actually Cryptonomicon, in the same way that Snow Crash was influential for people developing the metaverse, Cryptonomicon was hugely influential with the cryptocurrency movement and Bitcoin and Ethereum. So his Lamina One is backed by Bitcoin funding, but also it runs on a blockchain. So yeah, he's been quite influential, but yeah, definitely has had a kind of both sides perception of the metaverse.
You know, the thing you said about the metaverse as an escape from an unpleasant life reminds me that actually Philip K. Dick was ahead of everybody on this. I think it was the Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, wasn't it? Where you had the Mars colony and they would take this drug.
Choosy.
They would have these like dollhouse layouts and they would escape this really horrible life on Mars into these sort of beautiful houses and interact with each other, you know.
You take Choosy. And then you become part. It's funny because the Barbie movie is coming out this weekend, and anytime I watch the Barbie commercials, I'm like, that's kind of like the Philip Dick thing, and because they're all kind of realizing they're dolls, and yeah, they have that same part of the novel, like the guy is kind of, he's like a Ken doll, and then he's looking in the mirror and wondering, wait, aren't I someone else? And like that's before he comes back out into the real world and he's in Mars. So yeah, Philip Dick, obviously a huge influence.
That was also, that same concept sort of appeared in a film recently called Don't Worry, Darling, the film that Olivia Wilde made.
Seen that yet. No, I haven't seen it yet. I've heard.
And it turns out that that's a VR film. You don't really get it till the end, which I just gave away.
Yeah, okay, got to put a spoiler alert. Yeah. Yeah, I had a feeling it was something like that.
So how important, I mean, I know people who are in VRs all the time, or in metaverse kind of realities all the time, and they're like my grandson, who is a gamer, big time gamer. Games are where it's at, really. I mean, there's so much activity there that fits the metaverse model, or the, you might describe them as virtual realities. How important is the gamification part to the metaverse?
Yeah, I talk a lot about that in the novel, because Snow Crash is a very successful role model in many ways, in terms of the community being very strong and the ecosystem of content being very strong. But what one of the things that limited Second Life, and the reason why it's not grown past about 600,000 users, is very early on, Philip Rosedale, who I mentioned, he decided that it was not going to be a game. Like, it was originally marketed as a game, and they had gamification elements in the beginning. They had like a achievement system, so you could kind of become the most popular person in Second Life. But they removed those really early on with the idea, no, we want to make it a totally open experience, and we did not want to impose any of our point of view or any of our expectations, and it'll be a totally empty canvas. But what we found out happened is 99% of people who tried Second Life left almost within the first hour. Part of it is they just kind of went and said, okay, what do I do? And the answer that would come back from the dedicated users is, well, this is Second Life. You can do whatever you want to do with it. So there's no goals, there's no points that you can earn. But yeah, just the vast majority of people got overwhelmed by that. Just
my experience, like I went in there, and well, actually the first time, almost one of the very first early times I was on Second Life, I was interviewing somebody from some company inside Second Life. So we sat in some auditorium where he'd just given a speech. You know, he gave his speech in a little suit, and then he came back dressed in, you know, a t-shirt and jeans to do the interview. And I forget who it was though. And you know, then you sort of, oh, okay, you're supposed to explore this thing. But, you know, I didn't know anybody there. And so there wasn't an existing, like, couple of people I could go join and hang out with. And I found it very awkward, you know, the sort of the typing and the captions and all the rest of it. And I'm actually really well suited to things like Mastodon and the Well and other things where, you know, text is king, and you don't have to worry so much about visuals. And I think it's interesting that, you know, TikTok, everybody's flooding to TikTok. And I'm told that a friend of mine named Chris Stokel Walker wrote a book about TikTok, and he talks in the book about the reason people flock to TikTok is that it gives you really useful tools for creating the video you want. Most people aren't very good at editing video or you know, graphic design, you know, the things that work really well in something like Second Life, where it's a very heavy visual experience.
Yeah. I that's why I start the book saying the metaverse is not for everyone. It's roughly for 1 in 4 people who really enjoy immersive 3D experiences. Which, it, you know, mostly gamers, in other words, people who enjoy video game console games and games on their PCs or even VR or mobile phones. So, yeah, it's really the immersive element is something that I think a lot of my colleagues in the metaverse industry, they kind of underestimate the challenge that is for people who don't find 3D experiences enjoyable, or even the concepts of avatars. Are very foreign to people who are not gamers. The idea that you have a 3D representation on screen, and that's somehow you. And that's a conceptual leap that I think, unless you grow up with it as a kid, it's going to be difficult for people to make, unless you have like a very strong reason to make that leap. So for example, in virtual worlds, I find a lot of people, I'd say roughly 20% of people have either a physical or mental disability that makes it difficult for them to interact in the so-called outside world on a regular basis. And so they really hunger for an immersive experience and are willing to endure the time it takes to learn how to use an avatar and to customize it and to engage with people, because that's, it's filling a gap in their life. So it'll be for people like that and for people who just enjoy the 3D imagination space.
The Jim Carrey movie, The Truman Show, strikes me as being an analog version of life in a metaverse.
Could be. It's interesting. You know what's, when you bring that up, most of the metaverse experiences, the way people watch them, it's not in the virtual world. They actually watch it on stream or YouTube, because there's actually channels, like metaverse channels, that are on YouTube and have huge amounts of followers. Like I interview one of them, his name's Sir Moore. He's on YouTube. He has well over 1 million subscribers. And basically what he does, he goes into VR chat and finds people to interview, and he interviews them. They're wearing like Kermit the Frog avatars or whatever, but they'll often talk about extremely serious things, like in their real life, like abuse, like child abuse, or their veterans talking about their PTSD. But yeah, like the virtual world is really, it's kind of this environment that is constantly streamed on video. I mean, generally it's people who know they're being streamed, like the Truman Show, but yeah, it's just, there's a lot of broadcasting going on.
So what did Mark Zuckerberg think he was going to make? You know, I mean, what drove the change of Facebook to Meta and all of the metaverse talk that was, I mean, they seem to have kind of filled it up, but what do you think they were going to do?
Well, so it was partly inspired by Corey Andreka, the guy talking in the book. He co-founded Second Life, and then he led the acquisition of Oculus, started telling Zuckerberg 2014, 2015, that around then, about virtual worlds and talking about Second Life. And so kind of instilled that idea and instilled the idea in Mark that the Oculus would be the next great platform, that even as something that could be the replacement of cell phones or smartphones eventually. So I think that's been part of it. It's just basically they end up inadvertently trying to justify the expenses they've already put into the Oculus. And so the idea is, well, what's the great killer app for a VR headset? And so, you know, you take what Corey talked about, and then a lot of the Oculus people, they were less inspired by Snow Crash and more inspired by a later novel called Ready Player One, which is, it doesn't really add much to the metaverse concept. It just makes it more of a game, but they're really excited about creating a Ready Player One metaverse with the Oculus, well, now called the Quest headsets. So yeah, I think it's that and wanting the next big platform, definitely not wanting to be completely under the thumb of Tim Cook is a big thing, because, you know, they're especially now, like Apple, like actually changed some of the settings so that Meta collects less advertising from their smartphone apps. So they want an ecosystem that they control soup to nuts. In other words, the Oculus or the Quest headset, that they control not only the software but the hardware. So it's kind of all of these inspirations mixed up, and also kind of just, you know, naked self-interest and also sort of a sunk cost fallacy, like they spent all this money and they got to keep spending on it in hopes something will finally take root. Sort of a big irony that now they're back into social media again, because Elon Musk insisted on setting Twitter on fire, and so now they've launched Threads, so they've put more focus on that in recent years. But yeah, far as I can tell with Zuckerberg's motivation, it's kind of to be, have and control the next great platform, and he doesn't have much of a vision beyond that, far as I can tell. Everyone I talk to, that's kind of my impression, which is I quoted an internal survey where a majority of Meta employees say Mark Zuckerberg has not adequately explained what the metaverse even is. And that's his that's his employees that he pays. So,
well, at South by Southwest a couple of years ago, they asked Neil Stephenson about all of the hype and energy that you were seeing around the first idea once Mark Zuckerberg started making his play. And he said, yeah, it's just a bunch of marketing bullshit. I mean, that's kind of what he said.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Jim, this is slightly irrelevant, but did you ever see the Iceland tourist board's response to Mark Zuckerberg?
Oh, yeah. Join Real Reality.
The Icelandverse. It's a wonderful video clip in which the guy who's doing the presenting behaves exactly like Mark Zuckerberg. And he goes out, he talks about water that's really wet. And, you can't touch this because it's very delicate, but you can look at it. And it's just hilariously funny.
Yeah. No, it was great. And really kind of pointed out how kind of desiccated Zuckerberg's conception of the metaverse is, that it would be sort of the metaverse would compete with the real world. And what you want to emphasize is actually the fantastic, amazing things that you can do in the metaverse that you can't do in real life, that you can, become a 100 foot tall avatar, or you can become any kind of avatar you'd ever dream and go into all kinds of realities that don't exist. And they've never really got that right, because I talk about this in the book, that they wanted to make avatars look like the person in real life. Like even Mark's avatar, they created a Zuckerberg avatar that looks like him, which that's not how people in virtual worlds
sometimes really difficult to tell the difference between Zuckerberg and a robot or an avatar. he does not seem to flow like a human.
He might not know himself.
You also mentioned in the book that there are people who actually believe that at some point they're going to be able to upload their consciousness into the metaverse. That's a bit weird.
It's the same fantasy over and over again, And the other thing that really intrigues me is that if you go back to like the beginning of online communication, what did you have? You had synchronous messaging, chat. You had asynchronous messaging of some kind, and you had some kind of public forum discussion software. All of them had that in one way or another. And what do we have now? Everything always seems to me a reinvention of those three things. What do you do on Facebook? You exchange asynchronous messages, you exchange synchronous messages, and you have group chats. What do you do and that's what the metaverse is going to be. It's just going to be fancier, but it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be asynchronous chatting, synchronous chatting, and group chatting,
A lot of it, and shifted into different contexts. And with the metaverse, you would actually change the 3D immersive experience around you, and you can,
That was the other thing I was going to say, was you talk in the book about detecting things that are fake. And you mentioned Hawaii because you're from Hawaii. You say anybody who, and if you know Hawaii, you look at this and you can see that it's fake and it doesn't smell right and it doesn't. But actually, most people have not been to Hawaii. So how are they going to be able to tell the difference?
That's true. And the reason I kind of went into that was I've just seen so many virtual world recreations of Hawaii. And, they're visually pretty, but there are a lot of technologists, a surprising number, who think that if you give the poor people of the world a virtual version of paradise, that could be enough to pacify them.
Well, that's where Philip K. Dick comes in.
Yeah. I mean, an actual company's billionaires actually believe this, not as that would be really horrible, let's try to address the poverty and try to uplift people. But they, Palmer Luckey, like I quote in the book, he was the founder of Oculus. He was literally talking about that. Like, at some point, we're going to create the metaverse and we're going to give the poor a cheap VR headset. And they could be in Bangladesh and it's 120 degrees, but they'll be in the metaverse and it'll look like, they're by a waterfall in Hawaii. And that'll be great.
And in the meantime, in the real world, they'll be dying of dehydration.
So they'll think they're in air conditioning?
The VR experience will make them feel cooler. Apparently,
that's what this is reminding me of. This is reminding me of that guy whose name I'm blanking on, who wrote a book, published a book last year or the year before on the mindset these very rich tech bros. And it starts with him being summoned out into the desert.
That's Doug Rushkoff.
Oh, yeah.
That is Rushkoff. Okay. Do you remember the name of the book? But it's about being summoned. It starts with this story of being summoned out into the desert to explain the future to this group of billionaires. And what they want to know is not where you think technology is going, but, you know, where should we put our bunker? And how do we, the question that really set him thinking was the guy who said, how do I keep my private security force loyal to me? You know?
Right.
Yeah. That's in Survival of the Richest. That's the name of that
Survival
book.
Survival of the Richest. That's it.
Yeah. 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 No, it's wild. And yeah, the metaverse has been on the periphery, dragged into that conversation among billionaires of, you know, they're not even considering, well, maybe we need more government action, more democratic action to address the widening inequities, the haves and have nots. Let's create a technological solution and hope that that keeps the masses pacified and without us having to pay more taxes. And yeah, that's just wild. And just there's so many interesting things and so many potentials that we could realize within a virtual world that could make things a bit better for people across economic strata. That it's a concerning thing. It doesn't come up as much now. I think there's too many other apocalypses to worry about. But that's definitely something that exists that for people to be aware of, that actual very rich people believe, many of them.
Well, that's another thing that doesn't get discussed a lot in the book. But, you know, one of the big things that the stories that kept getting published during the Second Life heyday was its energy use. And, you know, I think the calculation was that a Second Life avatar consumed more energy than an actual person living in Brazil or something like that. And, you know, I was reading just this week that, you know, the tech companies are still building these big, expensive data centers in places that are already water stressed and where it's already very hot. And, you know, this is, you know, a text-based online system takes vastly less energy to run than something like the metaverse, where you're talking about all this immersion and graphics and 3D and so forth. So, I mean, is this something that metaverse people even seem to think about?
Not many. I've definitely thought about it. I think a lot of the way the server farms are managed, they try to make it greener, just even from their, you know, like Google's own interest. They need to make it more ecologically sound. But it's definitely a concern that, power consumption. I mean, the real power consumption problem, at least in comparison, has been the move toward Bitcoin, because people have been taking these 3D graphics chips that were made for virtual worlds, the metaverse, and they've been using it instead to mine Bitcoin, and that's been incredibly huge power consumption. That's been an issue. I mean, it's pushed people to try to be more conservationist, even just kind of paradoxically. If you spend all the energy to mine a Bitcoin, then you end up like paying your electric costs don't outweigh how much you make through Bitcoin. So they've tried to, you know, use solar power more and so on. But yeah, there's definitely an ongoing concern, anything internet related.
So is there
hopefully
a,
move in the right direction?
Was there a Web3 aspect to all this? Whatever Web3 is, I mean, it may just be hype. I don't know, but it's supposed to be like decentralized blockchain, that sort of thing. Does that have anything to do with the metaverse?
Yeah, I put that in. I have a chapter on metaverse myths, and that was one of my biggest ones. It's a myth that Web3 has anything to do with the metaverse. I mean, it can, and by Web3, that's basically cryptocurrency and blockchain related applications. So, yeah, that's in my view, the Web3 crypto bros have tried to glom on to the metaverse, because as it got a lot of traction because not only of Zuckerberg, Roblox as a metaverse platform that got really big, still very huge. And so they kind of want to say, well, see, we're kind of doing the same thing. We're doing virtual currency. And then there were some cryptocurrency-based metaverse platforms like Decentraland and Sandbox. And yeah, you can have a Web3 element, but what we've not seen is the thing that really matters is actual users. These platforms like Sandbox and Decentraland have active users in the, I think, 3 to 4 figures, like hundreds or thousands of people. So it really hasn't, none of them have taken off. And I try to get into it in the book that I think the core thing is that they're missing that a successful metaverse is about the user community first. It's about people who socialize together and enjoy socializing and creating together. And that's what has to be established first before you add a monetization element. But
well, that brings us to the question of governance in the metaverse, right? I mean,
totally.
Is it going to be some kind of decentralized governance? Will that work? Or, I mean, who is actually responsible for, I don't know, the politics of the metaverse? How does that actually work?
In 2008, I went to a virtual world conference. It was full of lawyers. And they started talking about how it would be really great to have like a village council. And they sort of outlined this elaborate system of governance. You know, I'm simply thinking, only lawyers want to go into cyberspace and argue about how to run things. Everybody else just yeah. wants to go and do stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, that governance, I might have gone to that conference because it's sort of like, okay, you know, nobody actually wants, huh?
It was in Singapore.
Oh, okay, I went to one in Stanford, but
yeah, I think I think that there were several around then. So
yeah, that's kind of one of the factors here is it's ultimately the metaverse is primarily for most people it's a consumer experience, so they want to go in to have fun, they want to socialize and create, they definitely don't want to sit there and talk about bylaws, and so I think I wouldn't say it's the ideal, but the least worst alternative is if you have multiple competing metaverse platforms and then the consumers can decide which one they find the most fair and most pro-consumer, pro-community platform. And then they can move to one at will. So if they find one is becoming unfair or has unreasonable monetization policies, they can finally say, and that's okay, that's it, we're going to this other one. Basically let these big companies handle the governance because they're the ones making a lot of money off these communities, and the communities should just have the freedom to leave them. And there'll be some definitely activism. I think community activism is important, but what usually is going to happen is they have to, the community has to get pissed off enough to actually organize. And the best metaverse platforms will not ever let a controversy get to that pitch where there's actually like an in-world protest, like you mentioned with the cans. There was one in Second Life, it was a tax revolt. So it was like a tea crate rebellion where they're making giant tea crates and they like the Boston Tea Party, but they're covering the world with tea crates. But it's a community. The company has to be very cognizant of the community and really engage with them. And
look what's going on Reddit, though. I mean, you know, yeah. The management has enraged the community, but
yeah.
Whether or not the problem seems, well, the Reddit thing is a little weird because basically the community is going to lose. They're either going to lose now because the management is going to ignore them, or they're going to lose later because what's going to happen is the company is going to go public and then it will be at the mercy of shareholders and they won't have a say then either. And
yeah, I think what'll happen,
a good outcome for it at all.
Yeah. I mean, well, what we saw with, I mean, the reason Reddit is so huge is because there was a previous one called Dig that had the very similar structure, but they outraged the community with some changes to the user interface. And the community kind of moved en masse to Reddit. And, you know, well, we're seeing that, we're definitely seeing that with Twitter, like the community, yeah, a lot of the community moving en masse to Threads.
But the thing is, what kind of threat is it? Because Twitter was sort of stumbling along okay until Musk took it over. Now it's losing money. Reddit was always losing money. If you look at Reddit's history financially, they've been getting injections of cash every few years.
Right.
So Reddit is not viable it's not self-sustaining as it is. That's really the central problem, is that, you know, the community is in a weak position because they can't say, well, this was a successful and profitable business. They can only say, you know, we don't like what you're doing, but they were costing, the company was losing money. So what is, how does it come out?
Well, see, right, this gets to the problem of having a community trying to make it part of a business. Inherently, if you start a business that is supposedly creating some kind of community or setting up a platform and letting a community form there, then, you know, if it's your business, you kind of are going to have to exploit the community. And that's not, at some point, it's not going to be cool. People aren't going to like it. I think we're seeing this now. Facebook, you have a lot of people who are really dissatisfied with Facebook. They still hang out there. It's not really, I would argue, it's not really a community. It's more like drive-by posting by various people. But it's a social environment where people can hang out and they can talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But they kind of cringe at the fact that they're served ads and there's an algorithm that decides what they're going to see, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that this is a tension we're going to keep seeing. And, you know, you have something like, in talking about Twitter melting down, Mastodon appears as an alternative, and Mastodon is more decentralized and cooperative. I think it's harder to build, because of the cost, if nothing else, a sort of virtual reality that has any kind of like sophistication, graphical sophistication, and that really works well. That's going to be kind of expensive, so it's probably going to be done by a business. But can that business count on having a community that's going to be happy with being part of that business?
Well, again, I'd say Second Life is a good model in this regard. I'd point out that in terms of monetization, Second Life is still quite profitable 20 years later. And one of the main reasons is they created a internal creator economy where the creative community makes as much revenue from the content they create and sell in Second Life as the actual company. So it's almost a 50-50 split. And that's really contributed to the creators staying engaged with the community. And there is actually quite a lot of like the online forum on Second Life, but also like on their social media channels that is quite large, and it's people who know each other. So it is a community. It's not just the virtual world. It's the, all of the social media channels built around it. And it's sustained quite well because the monetization is not specifically on monetizing their words. It's more about monetizing the 3D content, but that's enough to create the community or to create a community context. And then people, you know, they can chat about whatever, like they'll chat about Second Life, but then, you know, you look at the forums, they're chatting about politics and art and movies or whatever. But there is a way of achieving a happy balance. And I hope read the book helps people think about that there can be, and, you know, you can really sustain these things and just get the balance right.
One of the interesting things, though, is the way that some people bond with a particular platform or community. You know, Richard Bartle, who created the first multi-user dungeon, told me that he, I don't know if it's still true, but it was still, when he said it, it was decades after he set up MUD. He still had people who came in and played every day. They knew every nook and cranny of the game. They knew all the cheats, but, you know, this was their community, and this was where they liked to hang out. And, you know, I think online communities, you do get attrition, and you do get, like we're watching it happen with Twitter now, where, you know, people are sort of disappearing day by day, just kind of their accounts are just kind of winking out. But it takes a long, long time. Because, it, you know, if you have a hardcore of users, it takes a long, long time for one of those things to die. Mm-hmm. Look at the well.
I'm throwing up this picture, this image of the book, because we have reached the end of our hour. And I really want to thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you, John.
Because this is fascinating. There's so much to discuss. Yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Sounds great.
And I will counsel all who are watching. The press is Wiley. The book is Making a Metaverse That Matters, and you can find it pretty much anywhere you buy books. And you can find it in various formats. Is there an audio book as well?
Yes, that's coming soon. So yeah, check the Amazon listings.
Excellent. So thanks.
Thanks
to Wendy and Scoop. And
thanks, Scoop.
We hope to see you again
soon.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, that was fun.
Okay.
Thanks, this was fun.
Talk to you soon.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.